Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Rugby World Cup Weekly, our flagship Rugby World Cup 2023 review show. Despite talk of axing scrums, poor semi-final opposition and a lopsided draw, this incredible tournament is almost over and we barely had enough time to appreciate it. So joining me tonight are two contributors who need no introduction. Welcome back on to Tom Coleman and to Ed Price.
Cheers, Kevin.
Evening, Kevin. Evening, Tom.
It's always good to have you on, lads, as always. And we will start with Ed's Nation of England in the tense semi-final, I suppose you could call it. South Africa, hard-fought, dogged 16-15 win. Ed, I'll start with you. It's hard not to feel for England, and that's not even being sarcastic. It was a tough loss, but ultimately South Africa just do what they've done for 20 years and just found a way to get it done in a World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, to start off with, I think people are, this is the third time I've been on your pod, and people who've listened to me the last two times have heard me being very downbeat about England, and I was very downbeat before the semi-final. I thought, really, we weren't going to be anywhere near them. I thought we could be within 5-10 points of them in the last 10. That would be a real success. So to be leading with 3 minutes to go, as you can imagine, myself and my mates on who do the pod with me, it was borderline chaos in our households. But fundamentally, those mistakes cost you, from Farrell's back chat to the lack of depth and maybe even the incorrect selections in terms of the players for the World Cup. You know, people like Billy Vunipola, like Carl Sinclair, we had concerns and doubts about them being selected in the first place, and it actually came back to bite us. But you can't argue with the game plan and the execution of the game plan on Saturday night. I mean, Borthwick got it right. And the daft thing is, I think probably pretty much the entire rugby world knew that would be the game plan. It was the only real way that England could get close to South Africa. But they executed it so perfectly, or near perfectly, and it really was just that South African doggedness and fight, certainly in the scrums. And then, you know, a bit of magic from Andre Pallard to nail a very difficult kick in those conditions and at that time of the game. So you can't really say anything other than, you know, it's a huge amount of pride about that England performance. But if we're being serious and honest about it, that was the only way we're going to beat them. And if we'd gone into the final against New Zealand, it probably wouldn't have worked twice. And I don't think we probably would have had anywhere near enough to beat that New Zealand side. So would we want to see that style of rugby again? Probably not. What we have got now is maybe a little bit of something to hang on to with the future players that are coming through. like Chesham and Martin. Obviously, Stewart seems to be back to his best in that game. Itoje, I mean, wow, what a game. What a game, what a performance. And the only sad thing is we're going to lose the likes of Courtney Laws, who, again, I think has been immense this tournament.
Yeah.
But, you know, Ben Earl has sort of risen and become a bit of a talisman, despite all of his silly celebrations after a knock-on. And you know, there's the potential for a really ding-dong battle between George Ford and Marcus Smith and even Owen Farrell at 10. And I just one final thing on the England game and the England performance. I'll be criticised, and I mentioned sort of Farrell's back chat, and fundamentally it probably ended up costing us in the end. But his performance overall for against Fiji and against South Africa was immense. And the drop goal was nearly one of those all-time great England moments, but an incredible drop goal, incredible piece of skill. And I think he was also very magnanimous from the interviews I saw at the end. He seemed to be very magnanimous and actually quite open and honest, which is nice to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of something that gets batted at Owen Farrell that he can kind of be combative in interviews. We've seen it with, I think it was Sonia McLaughlin about 2 years ago, where he was really standoffish, but he did take it on the chin. And I think he knew that was England playing at their absolute max, and they just got beaten by a better team overall. Maybe not on the night, but overall. And that's what happens. And Tom, one of the big things that decided this game was set piece. And I'm going to quote Jeff Neville of Provincial State of Mind. He says, "Scrums don't matter until they do." And that was the general rule of this game. Oxenche in particular showed his class, but it highlights, like, for all the talk of expansive rugby and how enjoyable rugby is to watch, it just highlights the importance of set piece in these cup rugby scenarios.
It does. Just before I say, I'm just following up on Ed about Owen Farrell, I think considering Willie LaRue was acting the press at full time, he was quite calm. he was quite calm. Like, he had isn't his right to give him a smack because LaRue was a bit.
And I don't know if you've seen, but Orgeir Snaiman had about four English lads around him. And just like he did against Australia about 5 years ago, there was just everyone around him. And he's just, you know, head and shoulders above everyone else watching as everyone kind of goes to take down the big man.
I've never played in the World Cup semi-final, so I don't know the intensity and how wound up it is. But, you know, when you hear what Rico Ioane and Willy LaRue is like, you know, I'm not a big, you're exhausted at the end of the game if you're lost. So getting in a guy's face, you know, I have no time for that whatsoever. Give it the chat during the game. But like, it's final whistle. But anyway, yeah, look, you're right. Yeah, I think obviously Oxenche, and I thought he, you know, I know Pollard got a lot of highlights, but I thought Oxenche won that game for South Africa. That said, it shouldn't undermine what Cole and Marler done for the previous 60 or 70 minutes, because Kitsoff and Malherb weren't a factor in the game. And neither was Bungie at hooker. They, you know, they put him under pressure in both set piece and both lineouts. So I know Oxenche was on for the 20 minutes, and he was superb. But it doesn't tell the whole story for me of the game, because England did dominate a lot of the set piece for most of that game, and it was what was giving them the footfall. Like, Ed's right, and you know, England had a simple game plan, but they played it to 110%, and that's what was giving South Africa problems all game. Mitchell's kicking was on point. I thought Farrell's kicking out of hand was a bit iffy. A couple of times it was quite loose. I thought Mitchell's kicking was very, very good. He kept hitting the tram lines and really targeting the South African wingers. And obviously Freddie Stewart had a great game on the back of that, because, you know, he gave South Africa nothing on the reverse. Yeah, so, like, as you mentioned, the set piece with Oxenche, but Ed touched on it there in a sort of opening. Sinclair and Genge, who really are the starting props under Eddie Jones, really didn't give them the impetus that they needed for that last 20 minutes when he came on. And if you're not on point, Oxenche is such a, you know, he proved against Ireland as well. He's such a strong scrummager. And when it's pissing rain like that, and every, you know, the amount of knock-ons was going to be in scrums, then it becomes important. But I think overall, if you're looking at the 80 minutes, English set piece and scrum, obviously they stole lineouts. Ed mentioned Itoje had a great game. You know, that was Itoje 2019, 2020. You know, we haven't seen that for a while in England or Saracens. Maybe he got a bit disheartened under Jones. I don't know. Maybe what went on with Saracens for a year. But he, that definitely his juices were flowing. That was his best game in a long time. That was the Tolje that we'd seen before the last Lions tour. It was like, this guy's right up there with Evan Etzebeth. George Martin, I thought, was outstanding. I've only seen him once live, and that was actually when Leinster played over in Leicester, and he didn't really stand out. But I know that's a difficult, you know, difficult game maybe to stand out. Jasper Wavisa was quiet that day as well. But I thought he played really well. I think he's one for the future. I was surprised. I was a bit shocked Chessam was on the bench. I was going, what? I don't get Bartwick here. I didn't understand why Chess. Because I thought Chessam's been, I know Ireland's got the plaudits, but I thought Chessam had a really good World Cup. He really bolstered that English pack, and he performed in every game. Even at that little run down the line against, you'll have to remind me who it was, Eddie.
Samoa. Yeah, against Samoa. He scored the first try against Samoa. Yeah, no, he's been brilliant.
He had a very good World Cup. I was surprised. And maybe he didn't have the impact when he came on. He might be a starting player rather than an impact player, a tight head lock. But yeah, a couple of big penalties, scrums at the end, where both Genge and Sinclair were under a bit of pressure. And I think obviously Bartwick can maybe look at the selections there. Ed obviously looks a lot more Premiership than I do, and I do watch a bit. I think Sinclair's been struggling a bit with his scrummaging for a while. And Genge is one of those players, you know, let's put him in the Andrew Porter category. He tends to get away with sometimes the way he scrummages. And even against Ireland, he's gotten away with it before on Twickenham. And sometimes it eventually catches up with you. Oxenchea, when he did come on, he's the last guy you really want to be coming on and having difficulties in a set piece.
Yeah.
Because he's just one. But I suppose the disappointment from England's point of view is Fury, who was a makeshift hooker at best, was on at the same time, wasn't he? Or was he still playing?
So he was back row, but he was in the back row.
They kept Bungie on for the whole match, did they?
Yeah.
Both hookers went to full 80, I think.
They did. I think South Africa learned a lesson against Ireland in the last 10 minutes or 15 minutes where Fury did go hooker and was scrummaging, and South Africa lost that sort of forward momentum that probably would have won them the game maybe in that last 10 minutes. And that they obviously took that learnings and didn't, and kept Bungie on for the 80. But yeah, look, really tough loss for England. Like, it doesn't matter how the last 4 years ago, and England have had a pretty shit 4 years. And I know as an Irish fan, you sort of revel in that for a while. But like at the end of the day, it was a World Cup semi-final, and it just, you know, when you are the better team for, I'd say 90% of that game, some marginally better because it was a limited game they were playing. I was sort of screaming at them to be a bit more positive. There was times I thought they could have went to the corner.
When I thought
the coaching box, especially Razzie, seemed his, you know, bipolar decisions on making some of the substitutions of what he was doing. And then I just thought the emotional flow was with England. Every knock on, every 50-50, they were stealing lineouts. And sometimes that's when you need to court to corner. I get they needed to keep the scoreboard ticking over. But I felt there was a few times in that matches where you just had to grab the game with the balls, go to the corner and try and pull up seven, because there was South Africa were nearly on the verge of tipping over a few times. But look, hindsight's a great thing.
And on that then, I'll come to you first on this one, Ed. Like, the bench, we've talked about South Africa when they played Ireland and how important it is. England's bench did feel like they weren't going to be able to, they were being squeezed when they came on. You know, Vunipola made a poor attempt of a tackle on Tian Ferry, allowed him to get go forward for the try. The two props kind of struggled when they came on, which, listen, again, Oxenjea and Koch did very, very well. Orkay Snema did well for South Africa. To be fair, Chessam did all right off the bench and Danny Kerr, but it just kind of felt like when England needed something to change or just to help them over the line, their subs kind of didn't have it, whereas South Africa kind of did.
Yeah, I think, you go to that scrum that was in the corner, I think about 61 minutes-ish. So I think we put Fowler punched the ball into the corner. There'd been a knock-on.
That's right, yeah.
And we had the ball on their five, and it was that scrum. I think Cole and Cole had gone off at that point. I think Marlon maybe stayed on for another minute, but all the way around. But anyway, basically, it was that scrum that changed the game. And the criticism has always been, you mentioned, Tom, about Kyle Sinclair. His scrummaging has always been a weak part of his game. He has struggled against technically good props and powerful props. He gets away with it against guys who are a bit lightweight or in a pack which isn't quite as cohesive as South Africa's are. But you're right, and that quote is a really good one. You know, scrums don't matter until they do. But and I'd also sort of follow that up with, you very rarely win a game or win tournaments just via a scrum, but you can lose a game and you can definitely lose tournaments because of your scrum. And you're right, Kellen, the substitutions that England made, I felt they were the right. I thought it was the right thing to do. You know, South Africa were panicking. They were taking people off left, right and centre. And England, they were a bit more measured in terms of when they made the substitutions. But the key ones for me, obviously, Sinclair and Genge. I mean, Genge, I think, struggles because he's having to pretty much scrummage two props at one point because Sinclair was so poor. And then and then the other one was Vunipola. I mean, he wasn't on very long, but his unfortunately, his contribution was almost entirely negative. He came on early in the first half as a blood replacement for Curry, and I think the first thing he did was give a penalty away. Came on in the second half. First thing he did was put up a really poor tackle, as you mentioned, on Furry, and then gave another penalty away and made mistakes, and then obviously knocked on at the end. It is difficult because he's been a great player for England. He's been a superb player over the last 15. Well, I mean, he's only 30. This is the crazy thing. He's still quite young, but you know, he's been a great player over the last 12 years for England, the Saracens. He burst on the scene all those years ago, but it felt like it's just a tournament too far for him. And a year too far for him. All those injuries have certainly piled up. He didn't look fit. I mean, when he came on, I can't remember if it was the first or second time. I think it was the second time he came on, and he looked carrying a bit of timber, which
bundling on like a prop.
Yeah. And that's the thing. You know, you think of Billy Vunipola as this big, powerful machine, and he just didn't look like that. And I think the other issue was that outside of Mitchell had a great game. One poor kick in the first half where he got it a little bit wrong, but other than that, I think he was absolutely superb. But we didn't have the depth at scrum half, and that's not really Kerr or Young's fault. They were pretty much the only ones we had because of Van Poortvliet's injury. But although ironically that let Mitchell in, but we just don't have that depth in England at scrum half at the moment, or it doesn't feel like it. And then the other bit, I think, was probably a mistake, was I probably would have taken Jamie George off just to freshen up that front row. And it was interesting, I think, in the last couple of games, we've seen some of the most amazing bits of rugby you've ever seen in your life, but equally probably the worst line-out throw in the history of rugby and also the worst kick to touch ever.
It was very unfortunate.
You know, it's just almost ridiculous. Some of the most amazing play in the world, but also some of the work, like literally you would struggle to do that on Gloucester 3 on a Saturday in a park pitch. It was that bad. I think overall when it comes to England, the selections, etc., it was always going to be that last tournament for a lot of players. I mean, I've got in front of me, so Jamie George, Dan Cole, Joe Marler, Courtney Laws, Billy Vunipola, Danny Kerr, Ben Youngs, Elliot Daly, Manu Tuilagi, Johnny May, Owen Farrell. They're all over 30. You've then got Kyle Sinclair and George Ford, who are 30 as well. That's a lot of players to replace.
And a lot of games, especially like Farrell has played over 300 games. Even if he looks in great shape at the moment, eventually that's going to catch up on him. And it could well catch up on himself and Ford at the same time, which would be the ultimate disaster if they lost them at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, George Ford, I suppose George Ford has had nearly a year and a bit out with injury. Mm-hmm. Now, there's two aspects to that. One, it means he's not been through the mill in the same way that Farrell has. I mean, he's had his suspensions, but not as much as maybe he should have done. But Ford has had maybe a little bit fresher and also plays a very different game to Farrell. Farrell is a far more combative player, full stop. Ford is a more traditional 10 where he can kind of sit at the back and direct. I actually think, though, in some situations, certain situations, though, it does now open out to a huge amount of talent that's in the English game that's kind of been suppressed under Eddie Jones mainly. I can't blame Borthwick for this, because if you've got 6 months to change to go into a World Cup, who are you going to go with? You're going to either go full ball, you're just going to use your guys you know and trust, or you go, sod it, we're just going to throw this one away, which is kind of what Eddie Jones did with Australia.
That's what France did in 2019, to be fair. Like, they brought in the likes of Entomac, Dupont, Penault, lads like that in the very first year. I think Audrey could have been there as well, and Olivon. And it worked because they had an incredible 4 years. But also at the same time, they had a very bad 2019. So, I don't think Bortwick had the leniency to even go for that.
No, and I wouldn't. I think for a lot of England fans probably may have given him that slack, but equally, there's a lot of people only watched World Cup. That's their knowledge of England is World Cups and Six Nations. They don't know about rugby more generally. So it's a very difficult thing for you as a coach to say, chuck all these players out, and then you bring in all these kids. We do now have 4 years where we can actually say, look, we've got 10 players here, 11 players who we know are probably going to be retiring either in tech, you know, personally, they're going to say, oh, well, I'm hanging my boots up internationally, or you can quietly move them to the door. But again, there is a lot of talent. I should say that, you know, fundamentally, there is a lot of talent here. And it's not in the same way that obviously Ireland have been doing this already. They've been building those players through. You've obviously got key ones like Sexton, who is the next player, who is the next Johnny Sexton. It's not obvious at this point, but with England, you could change the style and we could play Marcus Smith at 10 now. That's not too much of a leap. He's done it before. We can play him there. I think the bigger issue for England is probably pack front row. We are going to have to trust some kids basically, and some young guys. And I think also scrum half, we're just going to have to play around and find that. We might find it. Alex Mitchell could be the scrum half for the next 5 years. Could be somebody else we don't know about yet.
You'd hope, just from the outside looking in, that I'm not saying England don't take the Six Nations seriously. Well, from perception-wise, Eddie Jones seems to continually, or under his tenure, seem to, you know, the Six Nations was just like a stepping stone.
Yeah.
And you would hope, I presume English fans would like just to get back to the basics as well, as going, you know, there's the Six Nations there to be won, you know, because if they they're good enough to be challenging, you know, 4 wins out of 5 and they're in a shout for a championship, you know, he won it the first year, and after that he seemed to, I don't know, you know, it was continuously bad results, but and then he'd brush it off. But yeah, you'd hope England would get back on the saddle there first.
Well, I mean, to win the Six Nations now, you have to beat, you're going to have to beat Ireland, France, Scotland, Wales, I'm not really worried about, and Italy. Right? Let's be honest. Italy, they've done well, but they've seemed to have fallen back. But you're going to have to beat Ireland, Scotland, France back to back, or near enough back to back, which is basically a World Cup. If you think of it that way, it's a quarterfinal, semi-final, final. And I think that's how England should look at it. We basically build into it. We've got to try, or you go for France, say, so we've got France first game or whatever. You just go, right, this is our final, hit that. Then next week, that's another final, hit that. It's about winning mentality. And we haven't had that in English rugby for a while now. And I looked today at the stats, you know, I think Borthwick's won 8, lost 7 of his internationals so far. You can give them a bit of leeway, hopefully going into the next Six Nations. At least I'd like to be challenging with Ireland and France. That's rather than worrying about, oh, we're going to get a win against Italy or Wales, which would be nice. Being Scotland again would be lovely, because it's been a while now and it's really annoying.
It's funny you say that. I just looked it up here. Like, England start with Italy away, then they've Wales at home, and then you got that rest week. Like, that's a good start for Borthwick in 2024 compared to, say, Ireland and France is the opening game of the Six Nations. Like, he's got a chance there to, he'll probably have a little bit of wiggle room to experiment and try some things. You know, you'd say, I'm trying to think of a good example, but maybe you see maybe Curry, Willis and Earl as a back row, for example, or maybe a Ludlam, and just try different parts and see what works. And then by the time they play Scotland in round 3, they'll have an extra week to prepare for that. And then they'll have an extra week to prepare before they play Ireland. There's no reason to suggest that he can't tweak a few things, you know, every little bit over the 4 years, and still be competitive, because he's shown they can still be competitive, even if it's not entertaining rugby. It's still competitive. They still got to World Cup semi-final and ran the possibly tournament favourites to, what, 3 minutes left in the game?
Yeah. I just think with England as well, I mean, there has to be, as I mentioned at the right beginning, we need to have a little bit more to our game than just always relying on an amazing kick chase. And I think that was always the worry going into this tournament. Look, fundamentally, we can play those conditions probably almost as good as anybody, if not better than anyone else. We can play those horrible conditions really well. But it was very telling when we suddenly had to throw the ball around in the last 2.5 minutes. No one had a clue what they were doing. There was almost no plan. There was almost no plan. You could clearly see it was like, right, we just got to kind of hope South Africa do something stupid and then we get a penalty. And that was very telling. And it was very similar against Samoa in the group stage and Fiji as well, really, actually. Once we tried to start throwing it around a bit, we did look a little bit lost.
And to be fair to Felix Jones, one thing that he did at Munster, he tried to make them a wide team. It wasn't really working because the centres and the tens they had when he was there. But considering Farrell is one of the best passers in rugby in the last 15 years, moving towards just getting it out wide, getting into mismatches with maybe it's a Henry Arundel type player or Freddie Stewart who has the strength, they could probably just piece together. But it's about evolution as opposed to revolution. Like, they don't need to rip up script straight away. They could just evolve. Like, that's, people don't like it, but that's perfectly fine in these 4-year cycles.
Yeah, and I mean, it does help. It might help that Arundel and Farrell might be on talking terms by that point as well. Allegedly.
Yeah. One rumor was the RFU, and the other rumor was Farrell. I don't know which one is scarier, your employer or your captain. Like, Tom, we'll just touch on South Africa again because they were, again, maybe not over 80 minutes, the worldly victors, but they do deserve their place in the final based on how the tournament has gone. Like, feels like this was always going to be a game that they kind of regressed a little bit because of the emotional energy of last week and the 6-day turnaround. But you still feel like they're not a bad team, but there is certainly elements of, you know, maybe a few concerns here and there because it was a panicky performance at the weekend. And if they don't get into that lead or get into kind of controlling the game, it could get panicky and it could start to unravel next weekend.
Yeah, I think, if you call a spade a spade, I think you've seen how good South Africa were against Ireland. I know they ended up losing that game, and how good they were against France. So, but equally, you can flip the coin, and they were awful last night, and they were lucky to get out of jail. And a better team, a more rounded team, I'd say, than England would have beaten them, and France, Ireland, and New Zealand would have. That said, would France, Ireland, and New Zealand replicate the sort of all the things that England did well last night, that remains to be seen, you know. But because what England did, the things England did well, they did very well. And like, I know South Africa won, but like, maybe it was a case of England just not having another arrow in their quiver to win the game. They whatever arrows they had, they used, and it just didn't have another one. That's the limited game. That probably could have been developed over the pool games, you know, the World Cup. I don't know. South Africa got out of jail last night, and they were lucky enough to get in. And I do think Razzie overcomplicates things. You know, I'm not a fucking international coach, and I'm sure if a Kiwi or a Baka listen to this, it's fucking Paddy. But I think Razzie overcomplicated things last night. His substitutions are baffling. Taking Etzebeth off 40 minutes into the game.
That had to be a line-out decision, though, because, like, to be fair, Mostert calling the line-outs wasn't really the issue, which I understand I'm kind of going against myself here. It was the throw-in.
I'm putting across it here. You've only so many line-outs in the game. Eben Etzebeth is probably the best second row. Best tight forward in the last 10 years, and you take him off. He continuously takes Khaleesi off.
Yeah, like, that one I don't get.
Which is, you know, this, you know, people have seen Khaleesi in the pool stages and other matches where even his ball handling skills, where he can pass out the back, he's got a skill set that he probably made a mistake not starting Visa over Dwayne Vermeulen. Dwayne was anonymous in the game. He was supposed to be there for that. Obviously, South Africa thought we're going to maul England, and England's maul defence was outstanding. They'd never, totally,
absolutely ridiculous. Italian laws had a different level game on that. The more defence, it was clearly they targeted it. You could tell they'd really targeted.
Splintered it, like, they just came straight through. It's what Itoje did when Saracens were in their pomp. He would just come straight through, sack the man, he'd get his hands on the ball, and you're going nowhere. Mm. Or maybe not on the ball, but on the man. And like, it was the one in the was in the first half in the right hand corner or second half, that was phenomenal.
Yeah, the first half. And then the George Martin hit as well, because it was a combination of the more they stopped the more, and then George Martin came around the corner and actually nailed him. And that's basically the South Africa try very cleverly. And this is why South Africa are world champions and why they are in the finals, because they are able to adapt. You know, that in the first half, mauled it. Second half, looked like going to maul it, peel around the corner, expose Vunipola, and the fact that he is often, you know, with that first minute, he's not concentrating. And then you're over the try line. You know, really clever, very clever play by South Africa.
Yeah, I think also that Creel and Dale Andy were so quiet. They had no effect on the game for at all. For two guys that have probably been the form central partnership in the World Cup, just totally nullified. And you're right, that you know, I hate picking on Billy, but, you know, his both his cameos were awful. Like, that bit where he's sort of standing at the back of the mall, you know, he's nearly meant to be touching the mall and ready for that snipe. He really had one job, and he fell asleep for a split second. Against the back row, Dion Fury isn't exactly Ardie Servia. You know, he's 38. You know what I mean? He's not, he's our Josh Van de Vleer. He's not that quick. And Billy just fell asleep. But he just looked a guy that just didn't look switched on at all. So, South Africa, I'm sure there's plenty of Bok fans, if they've been honest about it, realise they got out of jail last night and their performance was poor. And they didn't adapt to the conditions. They didn't adapt to England's press. They didn't adapt to England's aggressiveness. I just think England ran out of weapons to see it over the line, or there was a lack of belief and a lack of a game plan that's been there for a year that just didn't give them that extra string in the bow that they needed. I know I'm coming out with all the cliches here, but look, they're in the final. More luck to them, but they'll have to be a lot better than that to beat New Zealand.
Yeah, they will. And we'll move on to New Zealand now, because they were, maybe they weren't as at 100% like they were against Ireland, but they were really, really good. It was a very entertaining attacking performance in particular, as they, of course, returned to the final after that 44-6 win over Argentina. And I'll start with yourself, Tom. Like, I know it wasn't much of a contest and people were disappointed in it, but New Zealand were very impressive. And like, there is a lot to be said about a team who finds form at the right time. And this, at the business end of the tournament, is exactly when you want to be finding form.
Contest is doing a lot of the heavy lifting here, because as frustrating, you know, England came into the World Cup and, you know, we all knew England's form was quite poor coming into the World Cup, and how frustrating Argentina were in that opening pool game. Well, this was it multiplied by five. They were awful. And New Zealand, unfortunately, won that game somewhere between second and third gear. Like, it was over 50 missed tackles by Argentina. I know the missed tackle stats can be a bit skewed because you have shooters and people trying to push you back inside. But, like, even when the stat is that high, that says a lot. They looked like a team that was happy to get to the semi-final, and that was it. And I suppose getting the cliche out of the way, you know, sometimes with Argentina, their passion and this and that, you know, the whole Latin, that was non-existent either. There wasn't a bit of fight. They didn't get in New Zealand's faces. You know, even Lavanini was keeping his mouth closed, you know. So I don't know. I know there was times during the games where they felt a little bit frustrated with the referee. I know Montoya was not happy with Gardner, and I think they were hard done by in certain key elements in the first maybe 20 minutes. But yeah, as a contest, it wasn't. New Zealand won this game very, very easily. And on the back of the four quarterfinals last week, it was a very disappointing semi-final. Like, all four were fairly competitive to varying degrees. They were all good matches, like intriguing, entertaining. We didn't know what was going to happen till the end, but this one was a complete blowout. And that's not New Zealand's fault, but in some ways it's fallen nicely for them. They obviously spent, you know, whatever it was, nearly 300 tackles against Ireland to get that game before playing South Africa. Like, they'll bite your hand off and come back and bite your other hand for that. That was just... You know, people might say it's not ideal prep, but like, I guarantee you they'd rather not have another 250 plus tackle games to make again before they went to play South Africa in a World Cup final. As for New Zealand, look, we all know, we've all grown up looking at New Zealand at different ages. When the ball is going forward and there's no slicker team in world rugby, they will absolutely destroy you. Like, they're top of the try scoring charts for no reason, for a reason, and because when they're ruthless when teams aren't playing full strength or aren't at it. And Argentina just were so far off the races, you know. We mentioned Bath earlier on, or we were talking about Bath, and in the Premiership pre-pod, I remember Leinster going over in the Highland Cup playing Bath, and it was sort of that sort of a game where just not at the races at all. So, look, it's very hard to read into New Zealand. We'll have to look back at the Ireland game for sort of form on what they have to do to beat South Africa. And I'm sure South Africa will do the same thing and maybe look back against what went wrong against England. But South Africa will learn a lot more from their semi-final than New Zealand will, because it's near impossible to analyse, you know, where they're at on the basis of that game. Yes, the quarterfinal, but that game was just a one-way traffic, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, it was. And it's probably even an added luxury to New Zealand that they'll have that extra day advantage. You know, the fact that it was kind of set up that way, you know, it nearly always is in terms of the draw, but that they, whoever came out of, say, New Zealand and Ireland would probably get that extra day's advantage if they won their semi-final. But at the same time, just looking up here as you were speaking, it basically makes no difference in the last couple of finals. Like, every second one has been won by the team with the day less advantage. So maybe it's one of those talking points that doesn't need to be there. But Ed, as Tom touched on, there's no better team with go forward ball and with acres of space at times than New Zealand. Like, it was still impressive in the manner of how they got it done. Like, I know they finished with 14 men, some people were joking about that as well, because, you know, Scott Barrett got a very suspectly lazy yellow card at the end.
Yes, yes.
But like, their ability to just hit that gear, put the foot to the throat and have the game won by the hour mark, it's like New Zealand of old, even if they're not the team they were.
Yeah, I think I did see it. There's a lot of criticism about the game and about how one-sided it was. And I think fundamentally, you've got to just go back and go, New Zealand can only play what's in front of them, and what they played was brilliant for the first half. Certainly, they just ripped them apart, and they just had the, you know, as they put the foot on the throat and they kept pressing. It's not New Zealand's fault Argentina had no answers. And to a point, you know, as you say, if you're Argentina and you're thinking you're lucky to be there, as Tom said, or you're feeling that's the peak that you were going to expect, mentally, that's a really difficult place to go to. You think, oh, we can still get back into this game, and you're 20 points to 6 down or whatever. It's a difficult place mentally to be if you don't really believe in yourself. So I think it showed probably that killer instinct that New Zealand have lacked in the last few years, certainly since 2019. And I think that's a scary thought for South Africa, because it was interesting, I thought, when we all watched that pre-World Cup game, and South Africa gave New Zealand an absolute tuning, particularly in the up front in the pack. And I think if New Zealand can get parity, or, you know, barely parity, and just can kind of just keep that scoreboard ticking and really move that South African team around, you could see them doing something similar. I mean, I'm not saying South Africa have got that tenaciousness, and I wouldn't expect them to just roll over like Argentina did, but you can definitely see New Zealand, if they press on that gas and go for it, they could be 2-3 scores up, and it's a long way back for a South African side that's had to put two huge performances over in the quarterfinals and semi-finals. And New Zealand have basically had, you know, a really massive game against Ireland, a kind of a walkover against Argentina. And then, other than that France game, the first group game, which they didn't play badly in, they've had a quite nice, easy journey through. I'm not aware of many injuries, and I don't think the Scott Barrett that's going to be cited and moved up to a red or anything. I think that's just going to stay as a yellow. You've managed to get a really amazing reaction out of Talia. You know, leave him out of the quarterfinals for staying out a little bit past curfew. Which I mean, if, again, brilliant decision, brilliant management. Obviously, they'd lost, probably not the best, worst, great bits of management, but they've managed to sneak past Ireland and have got through. And then you've now got a player who's basically saying, oh, I want to be in the final, and had a great game. And then you've got, you know, someone like Jordan on the wing who's scoring tries for fun still, which almost seems illegal that he's, every time he gets the ball, he scores a try. And they do look a really, really good team who've built into the tournament. Whereas, say, South Africa, you can definitely see them winning. But my sort of opinion of it is, I think they might get to a point now where they just haven't got a lot left. It's a lot of effort, a lot of emotion that they've had to go through to get to this point. But one thing I would say, though, as well, just a final thing on the draw and the, you know, the, all of the things around the draw. And I know from an Irish point of view, there's a lot, quite understandably, there's a lot of annoyance about this. It was clearly a flawed concept because the World Rugby have dropped it for the next World Cup. I think what we've ended up with is the two best teams in the tournament playing each other.
I think
overall that's worked to a point. Apart from last night, all the other games were really competitive in the knockout stages. Friday night. And you get games like this in every tournament. I mean, I think back to the World Cup final in 1999, and France just got blown away by an incredibly good Australian side. Or, you know, you go back to 2000 and even 2003, England France. You know, for England, France just didn't turn up. England played them off the park and didn't have to do a lot; just kick points. So it happens. And then, you know, the football analogy is obviously 2014, Germany 7, Brazil 1. Those results happen. It's weird. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. So I know there are a lot of Irish supporters probably quite annoyed that they weren't able to fully experience the mauling of Argentina. I mean, there would have been a revenge upon revenge for that. And I understand maybe there's a bit more extra bitterness that they didn't get to have that fun. Because I doubt there would have been the calling for though, this is the draw. See, this is what happens when you
not a bit. No. And to be fair, Jackie Hurley, the presenter on RT, she did make the point, like, if Ireland went out and won 44-6 over Argentina, we'd be saying, well, right, we're in a great place, you know, like this could be the year. But it's just, it always changes. Like, the picture always changes when being a neutral and being a fan. Like, it's just the nature of sport, really. Like, you know, I just want to get your thoughts, Ed, on Argentina before we kind of move off, because, like, they're in England's pool, as Tom said, they just completely no-showed against England in the first game in Marseille. And, like, there was kind of, I think on this podcast particularly, we kind of questioned whether there was substance behind their revival when you look at the games they played, and, like, they did not boast their reputation one bit on Friday night. Like, that's just, I think in some ways you could just say it's just not good enough from them, the fact that they just weren't at the races at all.
Yeah, I just think they're probably, as I said, semi-final is about as good as they probably thought they could get before they started the tournament. The only performance, because they beat New Zealand recently in the Rugby Championship, there was that sort of perception, oh, it might happen again, you never know. But actually, normally what happens is they'll play well for 35, 40 minutes, and then eventually New Zealand just smash them, and they'll put 20, 30 points over them at the end of the game. So that result last night Friday night was not unexpected. You know, let's be honest, it's New Zealand versus Argentina. 99 times out of 100, New Zealand will put 20 points, 30 points on them. But you normally get a bit more of a fight. The game that I can't quite fathom what happened was the England game. And maybe, again, it's just that England played the perfect game that night for the conditions and for the position they were in. And Argentina just didn't have the answers. I don't know. It seems to me that there seems to be a bit of a weird thing with Argentina, that they want to play that really expansive, exciting, sexy rugby, but then you've got this almost themselves holding them back, that they think, oh, we've got to kick it because the best teams kick it. And it's not their natural game. And their pack isn't quite as annoying as, like you said, Lavanini. You know, you always guarantee you get a yellow card out of him. I mean, he's not been, he hasn't seemed as combative. The likes of Montoya and others, they don't seem to have that sort of grit and annoyingness about them, which they always used to have. So I don't know. It's just, maybe it's just, it could just be they've got to the end of their cycle and actually just need it. They just need a refresh. And check. And it, but to be fair, it's Michael Checker. I don't like Michael Checker, so it's quite funny.
I was there. I was in Crow Park at the top of the Hogan Stand in 2009 when Leinster had handed us our arses. So I can double down on that. To be honest,
mine's from it as an England fan in 2015, and just seeing Checker's smug face as they knocked us out of the tournament. It was nice to see him get handed a bit of a thumping.
Well, he, in fairness to him, win, lose or draw, he always looks like a guy when he's coming down from the coach's boxes that he's ready to kick the referee's door in. He only has one, so I have a different view of Checker. He obviously
that's fair enough.
I can get that.
And to be fair, there are rumours of him moving on from the Argentinian job. He has done a good job, all things considered there. As you said, there's probably that element of reaching their ceiling by getting to this semi-final. And like, it, everything in perspective and everything is relative, because Argentina, for them to beat Wales by 12 points is a big result for them, because like they showed they weren't that much better than Wales in that game. You know, Wales and Argentina are pretty level. They bet them by 12 points. They go through. And like, that does have that knock-on effect. And then you're going to play New Zealand, who hammered you in your own backyard this year. You know, realistically, third is probably what Argentina were aiming for anyways. That does kick in, you know, especially with an older squad, as you said. And I don't know. I wouldn't be overly critical. I think it's fair to ask the question, but I also wouldn't be overly critical. And just whichever way he wants to jump in. Is there anything you'd have taken away from that game then, that looking ahead to the final, or is it just kind of, I've seen that coming in some regards?
As in
for New Zealand, like, is there anything that you could say, well, you can look at this ahead of the final, be it, you know, the likes of Will Jordan's form or whatever?
I think the main problem New Zealand have to sort between now and the final is their bench. I'll be amazed if either Finlay Christie or Damian McKenzie see any minutes in the World Cup final. I think Aaron Smith, like they did against Ireland, Aaron Smith and Richie Mwanga will see out the 80 minutes. Bowden Barrett might have to slot the 10 if he doesn't. So what New Zealand do with their bench is a big thing for me. I think they literally have a 21-man team at the moment, because barring injury, I can't see those two guys getting anywhere near the pitch unless the game is out of sight. If that game's in the pot, and that therefore substitutions become a factor, then they're only coming on when the match isn't a factor, those two guys. So there's a strong argument for New Zealand to go at least 6-2 on having another back row player alongside probably Papali'i on the bench, because the one consistent thing, forget about the sort of, or maybe if you want to include the Twickenham abomination against South Africa, but the games against France, the games against Ireland, where they won one, lost one, and you know they could have lost two, is they do give up possession and territory, both France and Ireland. And as South Africa showed, that's not a game plan that will work against South Africa. So I think New Zealand will have to defend a lot like they did against Ireland, but for, you know, even more relentless. Absolutely, New Zealand have strike runners in open play to get the try off lesser possession. But I think the big thing Foster has to do is sort out his bench for South Africa. And even with that, the two props, he's not fully trusting of them either. They came on late against Ireland. They got a good run against Argentina, but to be honest with you, I think me and Ed could have come on against Argentina and prop for New Zealand. Maybe that's a bit unfair to Argentina, but
I think it's very unfair to Argentina if you're including me as a prop. I say
there were 40 points up, Ed. Surely we couldn't lose. But I think that's the, yeah, I just New Zealand's bench hasn't been tested, and they haven't gone to their bench in games where they have been tested. And I don't know what they can do different besides bringing maybe another back rower in. But that, for me, that'll be the interesting thing when the squads are named, to see will New Zealand do anything different. Because I presume the game will be unless South Africa are emotionally spent from tough enough pool and you know the matches against France and then against England, unless they're a little bit emotionally spent, because they do rely on emotion. You know, I mean, how often you can get up that, you know, the South African team can lose leading it, so what. And it's bigger than the team and the country and all this sort of stuff. I don't know how often you can go to that well every single time. You can't keep going to that well, you know, all of the time. I just that's the biggest thing for me for New Zealand, I should say, to try and work out between now and when the squads are named. Because for me, in some ways, they're sort of playing with a 20-man team, because their legs strength was trusting of their reserve props. Coles and Whitelock will come on all right, no doubt, if Whitelock is on the bench and Retallick starts, or vice versa. Papali'i will get a run, but you know, after that, they're very hesitant about trusting what's on the bench, and they'll need to do something. As Ed touched on it, South Africa will be there, and will, it doesn't matter if they're 10 points down with 10 minutes to go, if those same props come on, Ox and Fury come on in the back row and Quagga comes on, and all of a sudden South Africa start to find some front football. They've shown against France and they've shown against England that they will win it at the death when they need to. And you know, New Zealand have been in that position against Ireland where they held on at the death, but I think they'll need something more against a fresh South Africa, which I don't know if they are or not. To guarantee a win, but to win.
I think the other thing as well, there's two aspects. One is the discipline. You mentioned it kind of, Tom, really, but which is about the making sure you're not giving away possession and territory. Mm. So if New Zealand can replicate the last 5 minutes they did against Ireland, which the 3 minutes against Ireland with 37 phases, where not, and actually being very, very clever, waiting for the opportunity and going in at the right time. If they can do that prolonged, that will be a massive thing. And then the other aspect, I think the other bit as well is for New Zealand is what they need to do and what France didn't do and what England tried to do but didn't really get the opportunities because the scrum went against them is just build that scoreboard pressure. I get the feeling New Zealand have got the players and they've got the ability that they can just go, right, for the next 12, 10, 15 minutes, every time we get in there 22, it's going to go for a drop goal. And I get that's probably the only thing South Africa just can't, they, you know, you can't defend a drop goal if you do it properly. There is no way to defend a drop goal. And I get the feeling that New Zealand have got the right players, the right technicians who can do that on a regular basis, and make South Africa, even if, and then you're making them stress, you're making them make mistakes, and just keep the ball anywhere near the scrum. Don't let them. Particularly when Oxenchey and other people come on, you know, just don't let them get in a position where they can take 3-4 scrums, get on that side of the referee, and that then becomes an issue. But
the template was there against Ireland. They didn't give us one scrum on our own ball.
No,
we had no scrums in that game, not one. I'm not saying it would have been an attacking weapon, but it just shows the quality of the handling from New Zealand for 80 minutes not to cough up one scrum.
No, and then all you're doing really then as well is if you can kick the ball, and they do again. They have the players that can play territory. It's a really fascinating final. I mean, the fact that you've got the two most successful nations in World Cup history playing against each other, one of them is going to end up with a fourth World Cup. It's pretty cool. You know, it's like, and the fact that the last time they played in a World Cup final was the Mandela final, and I imagine New Zealand will be steering clear of any outside catering this time.
But it was the outside perspective.
It's good they make their own food, you know, rugby values. They're all in the kitchen there cooking their own dinner and
Well, if they can move a Land Rover, they can definitely chip in and make a Bolognese, can't they?
They definitely did some damage to that car with the way they moved it as well. Like, it was.
I just like the idea that the bloke was stood there with it, where it's like, I'll move it, lads. It's fine. I'll move it. No. You wait. We've got this is going on TikTok. You have to wait now.
Yeah, some poor young lad with a tripod having to film it, like, just not necessary. New Zealand. I won't say bashing. Rugby values bashing aside. As you said, Ed, like, the only final between these two sides was 1995, which seems crazy, you know, because it feels like it's been the rivalry of the last 40 or 50 years. South Africa have never lost a World Cup final. New Zealand, that's the only World Cup final they've ever lost.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many different parts. I'll start with yourself. Like, which way do you see it going? And how do you see that game being won? Because, I mean, in reality, there's about 17 different ways this game could be won or lost.
Yeah, I think New Zealand won't do what England did. They won't just kick and put pressure on the wings. They will play because it's New Zealand. My feeling is I tend towards New Zealand just because I think as this tournament has gone on, they've improved and improved and improved. You know, even daft stuff like the hammering of Italy, the fact that they didn't stop, that as soon as they got, because normally what happens, you get to 40, 50 points, you make your substitutions, the tempo's lost, people start doing things and they knock it on. And they didn't do that. They just kept going. And I know Italy caved and gave up, but that was the game I thought, oh, hello. They might be, interestingly, this could be interesting, particularly when they get to the quarterfinals. I think they got very lucky, you know, and I'm not just saying it because I'm on your pod, Kellen, but that they did get very lucky against Ireland. I think it was a couple of decisions, a couple of errors ended up going their way. But I just think they've got so many attacking threats. And I think if they can build a score, that's the thing. If they can build a score, get 10, 12 points ahead with 20 minutes to go, I think it's asking a lot. For even if you have the bomb squad and all the rest of it come on, I think it's asking a lot for South Africa to chase that down. If it's tight, if we are talking one score into the last 10 minutes, I might tend towards South Africa just because of they've done it. You know, they've done it against France, done it against England.
And there's always something to be said for a team who's just been there, done that, and they had to do it the last World Cup as well.
Yeah, against Wales.
Like it was against Wales, and even the first half was cagey enough against England in that game. I know they pulled clear eventually, helped by the was Lekanyuama got the try.
Oh yeah, Lekanyuama won, and then Colby finished off at the end.
Yeah,
thanks for reminding me.
And that was not my intention. Tom should have jumped in there and saved the day, really. But like they've had to go and just grind it out. New Zealand, we don't know, can they do it yet? And to be fair, if they do go and grind it out in a big game, there's no better place to do it than in a World Cup final.
No.
Tom, I'll come to you as well. Like, which way are you leaning as of now for this one?
Well, first of all, the one reason I'm disappointed England aren't there, we're deprived of the riveting face-off in the press conference between Bortwick and Ian Foster. That would have been fun. That would have been fun.
Yeah, charisma and charisma too. Yeah, I know.
That would have been fun. Look, yeah, it's like it's hard to disagree with what anything Ed said there. It could go several different ways. The criticism I said earlier on about that's about Khaleesi constantly getting hauled off early actually might pay off, because they've only played two half games basically against France, or a little more than a half game against France and against England. And you know, there's two guys that you could argue would be in a, you know, world 15 pack if you were to sit down and to three of us name a team. So they could be a little bit fresher than and they'll need that as well. The weakness, as I pointed out, maybe in the New Zealand bench, surely I'd say Bongi must be running on fumes at this stage for a hooker, and he's going to have to do another, like the whole Fury hooker experiment against Ireland backfired. And, you know, they called up Am and he's not nowhere to be seen. And, you know, where's the hooker? You know, that's another, you know, what's the point of that there? Like, you know, Razzie has made some really weird calls in this World Cup, and he's gotten away with it by the skin of his teeth, and that's another weird one, you know. But he'll get a free pass because, you know, he's won the games. But that we've been saying for now a few weeks that might come back and bite them in the ass. If Bungie gets injured during the game, I think that could be the game nearly gone.
There are rumours that he might not even be able to play anyway, depending on if what you said to Ben Curry is true.
I feel like that's going to die down based on what Curry said.
I think Ben Curry, to be fair to him, has kind of tried to stop it. I think he said, look, there's no point talking about it, let's move on, which seems fair.
Yeah, I've seen online a lot of Afrikaan translations.
There's some very desperate Afrikaans translations. the balls at the side, apparently. That's what he said.
I slightly favour South Africa, but not by a whole lot. It'll be interesting to see what the tacticians come up with in both squads, whether it be Joe Smith, who's obviously made a difference to New Zealand since he's come in there, and what Razzie does, because they look to be a bit of disquiet on the South African boxes. There was a lot of raised voices throughout the game. You could see at one stage Felix Jones and Razzie seemed to be going at each other about something or other. So I'm not sure if anyone's a Star Trek fan. It was the unwinnable situation where we don't want either to win. As an Irish fan, I couldn't really care less who wins. I'm just looking for a good final, and I think South Africa, just because they've been through the mill a few times in close games. What do you think, Ed?
Well, I was like, Ken's gone. So, I think you're right. It's going to be close. I mean, that's the thing. It's going to be close. I personally would like to see New Zealand win over South Africa. I'm a bit tired of the Razzie show. I don't know if that's a thing just for maybe just English supporters, but I'm a bit bored and tired. It's a bit like
Eddie Jones. I agree as well. He's too smart for his own good.
Yeah, it's a bit like Eddie Jones as well. I just think, you know, you get so much of a shtick, and you think, actually, do you know what? I'd rather we just concentrated on the rugby rather than some bloke mouthing off on Twitter or, you know, doing all these weird and wonderful things. And I'd love it if. Not to go all Kevin Keegan, I would love it if something controversial happens and in New Zealand get a nice late winner just to annoy Razzie. That would be quite nice. But actually, what I really want is a really good final. Well, I mean, if we can get something close to how good 1995 final was, I'm old enough just to remember it. Anything as good as that would be nice. I think we're due a good World Cup final.
Going after sort of a Kiwi Journal during the week was a bit. You know, I don't know if you've seen that.
Ben, yeah. Again, it seems to be, I don't know if it's like the Alex Ferguson, Jose Mourinho style thing. He's just trying to deflect. But I just think to myself, look, there's a game of rugby. And actually, we talk about rugby values and a lot of the stuff that's happened in the last 3-4 years where that erosion of rugby values, you could almost argue that Razzie has been the person that has been the starter of some of that. And I think actually getting back to the respect for the referees, moving away from this idea that everything always comes down to the referee's fault, when actually you've got 80 minutes of rugby where you can make a big difference. It doesn't have to be the referee and a scrum. As I mentioned at the beginning, Owen Farrell has got his own self to blame for mouthing off at the referee. It's nothing to do with who's hinging in a scrum on the 77th minute.
Yeah, but
the reaction after DuPont. You know, DuPont went out of his own World Cup. The whole fractured cheekbone. He is literally plastered and everything. You know, I've been over in Paris about the game, a few games. He's the face of the World Cup. And did that press conference after the game. Yeah, he said it wrong, but there was no leeway there. He didn't sit down like Latin the week after and make an hour-long video on fucking YouTube complaining about it. Showing, you know what I mean? So, you know, the whole moral high ground there, I'm like, really, come on. you know, the guy was an emotional pitch straight after the game, gutted. Yeah, he was disappointed with the referee. But, you know, DuPont is normally quiet as a mouse. You know, we've all seen him for France and Toulouse, and he's a top pro. We all know how good he is. And if he was frustrated, then fine, I'd give him a pass. But, like, it's not like he's taking the social media with 15 different alt accounts.
Yeah, there's no previous with DuPont. There's no...
No,
past comments. There's no nothing, and like even I made this point last night when I seen it. Like I can forgive Antoine Dupont, as you said, being the poster boy of this World Cup since what 2021. Like not even just this year, but like the last 2 or 3 years, and he's hurt and he had been injured and he didn't have his best game on the night. I can forgive all that, but then you also have the tireless ref debate that goes on that has been going on all week. And, like, I know Ben O'Keefe was booed in the stadium last night, and that one's on the fans. But, like, if you're asking the question that, or if you're saying that Ben O'Keefe cost England the game in front of millions on TV, what do you expect is going to happen afterwards?
Yeah, Delalio was way out of order. Massively. Yeah, I don't know if you've seen this. Delalio was huge, massively out of order. It's just not, it's not acceptable. And I think that it's, and I'm not saying Razzie is entirely to blame for this, but I think it feeds into this increasing narrative. And again, you know, you want to, I want to win. I want the team that doesn't annoy me, and South Africa annoy me. they just, the constant chatting, the constant, like Faf de Klerk, brilliant player, but all he does is whinge. I mean, one of the reasons, again, looking from outside and in, one of the reasons why, bless him, Johnny Sexton gets a lot of grief from opposition supporters is because of the perception is because of what, you know, his whinging moaning or perception of the whinging moaning. Dan Bigger, brilliant player. Everyone hates him because or dislikes him because he's always whinging and moaning. People don't really like, you know, you think about some of the Saracens players like Owen Farrell because of the whinging and moaning. There's a competitive edge to it, but you can be respectful and you can ask the question. I thought Joe Marler was a good example last night. I think there was a penalty against Joe Marler for, I think, possibly hands in the ruck.
Yeah.
And he just said to O'Keefe, he said, next one though, ref. And O'Keefe went, yeah, next one. Wink in his eye. And, you know, you can do it and you can play with it and you can be nice and you can be cheeky and you can do all these little things which you can do in a far more respectful, far more what rugby values in inverted commas way. And I just like that to be hopefully what the final's remembered for
You're dead right, Ed. And I this comes, you're right. A lot of it comes down to the players. The one criticism that I would have of O'Keefe was the chirping started from the get-go from both teams. You could hear it visibly through the mics. Every ruck was from both sides. And look, I'm an affiliate referee, which is, you know, referee youth rugby in Leinster, and not, you don't have to say that to underage players. You just there's none of that goes on because it's not accepted, and it's not accepted in any division in England.
No,
I haven't been over there. It's not, you know, it's in Munster or wherever you want to be. It's just not a given. You speak to the referee with respect, but it's this constant, it's like screaming for offside every 2 seconds. And O'Keefe, I felt, just needed to really stamp that out in the first few minutes, because I think if you let players away with that, then they don't listen to you around key decisions. The respect level seems to drop, and then the game starts to get messy, and then all of a sudden it opens it up to the players going in off their feet or this, that, and the other. I know it's too simple to say O'Keefe should have been a bit more firm with the chirping and but it is a bit of a problem. And this is nothing to do with rugby putting themselves on some pedestal against feckin' football or whatever. It's nothing to do with that. It's just that the nature of the game and how the game is played, it's physical. You can hurt players if you want. So therefore you have to have respect for your opposition, because if you don't, you could really hurt somebody. And, you know, that extends to the referee having respect for him or her. And if that sort of ebbs away from the game, from both the coaches and the players, and the referees sort of let it happen a bit, you know, like O'Keefe did, I felt, you know, it's not a great road, I think, to go down for our sport.
No. I mean, the good news is, because England are out, we're going to probably get Wayne Barnes. So that's
the reporting this evening anyway. That'll be Wayne Barnes, which is...
Carl Dixon, surely.
He's a friend of our pod, and we'd be delighted. I mean, that'd be a great boon, you know. But
maybe not for a World Cup final.
No, maybe not for a World Cup final. That might be a pushing it a tad.
they're still, I heard, well, the reports anyway are that they're waiting on Jacko Piper's fitness to see who gets the third, fourth place game, which is a new one in rugby. I can't say I've heard that one before.
I think, isn't it? I mean, you're assuming that Jacko Piper's his last ever game, isn't it? That's the.
I'd say so, yeah.
That would be, or certainly last ever international game. And I'm assuming that's also going to be the case for Wayne Barnes. I can't see him maybe. If he gets World Cup final, I don't think that'll be they'll be doing much more after that. Which and Barnsley's been a wonderful referee for a long time. And I as an Englishman and as a guy who he lives there, he comes from just down the road. He comes from Lydney, which is like, you know, 6-7 miles down the road from where we live. So be nice for a local lad to get the World Cup final.
Yeah, absolutely be good. I thought Luke Pearce was a little bit unlucky not to get it.
I agree.
Yeah.
Very. He seems to be the heir apparent. And again. Yeah.
It was very odd. And even I put in a poll in a group there today about Pierce Barons or even Amish Kelly. And Amish Kelly got a good vote and he had a good tournament.
Mm.
I don't see him see World Rugby giving him the final, but it is good to see there are refs coming through and doing well. Nika is very young. Luke Pierce is still relatively young. Even some of his assistants, the likes of Karen Dixon, Christoph Ridley, who could well be the assistants at the weekend, they're young enough as well. And so on, and like ref chat is boring, but if we are praising them, it's not near as bad. It's the you got X amount of decisions wrong. That's the issue. As lads, you may have noticed my laptop dropped in the middle of your prediction. So just in a word, Ed, who's winning on Saturday?
New Zealand.
Tom?
I was saying South Africa all along, but Ed keeps reminding me how annoying South Africa are. Well, I'll stick with South Africa. I think, I'm worried about that New Zealand bench the last 10 minutes and 15 minutes. I'm worried about the depth of it and the players they won't use. So, in a word, sorry, two words, South Africa.
I've said at the start of the tournament that it would be a South Africa-Ireland final. Ireland beat South Africa in the pool. Ireland beat New Zealand. South Africa beat us in the final. So, if South Africa beat New Zealand, my entire tournament predictions was off by one game. So, kind of want to go for that. Never mind the whole Sean Klein or guess name and thing. My tournament predictions could come up very, very good if we get come up with it. Lads, thank you very much for joining me. It's been brilliant, and not just to talk about the games, but even a bit of bigger picture chat there at the end is always good to get as well. And for coming on for the duration of the World Cup as well, it's always great to get an outside perspective like your own, Ed, in particular. And to everyone at home, thank you very much for joining me. I'll be back later this week with preview and recap pods of the final and maybe a bit on the third, fourth place game as well, I suppose. And you can also catch me on episode 3 of the Red Army podcast, which returns this week as we look at Munster's victory over the Sharks at the weekend. As always, thanks at home to the lads for coming on and to everyone for listening. If you like what you see here, please do subscribe. You find the links for my channels below as well as the lads' Twitter pages and so on and so forth for as long as that's around at the very least. But for now, and until next time, take it easy.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.